Welcome back to everybody. This is our last class before Pesach, I believe.
Yes.
And
you should start, but Ellen and I won't be here because we'll be getting paid. No, you should start. I just said
we actually only have one class left on Shimshon before we finish Shimshon. After this one. In other words, I had hoped to finish Shimshon by Pesach. I'm one class shy. So, and I don't think we're going to schedule a class for next week. So that's not practical.
No.
So it'll have to be that one class after Pesach. Maybe it'll stretch it too. I doubt it, but I really...
You can come watch it. Oh, no, but we have another class.
It's fine.
So, but that's really, we are on a home stretch on Shimshon, and then after Shimshon we start a new unit, Pilagish Begiva and Pesel Micha. Right now we have to finish Shimshon, and I promised you a resolution of the mystery of last, with which we left off in last class, correct?
Yes. I thought it was very interesting, though, that she talked to me afterwards about the three times.
We're going to come back to that. We'll come back to that.
I thought that was quite interesting.
We will come back to that. I mentioned a little bit briefly Shabbos afternoon. We're going to do it again. We're going to put it all together. Bezrat Hashem. That's our agenda for today. If we finish our agenda early, I may leave you early. I may let you go early, but we'll see. You know, it's like, dismiss the class early because you finished the curriculum?
No, because you have to clean.
All right, so let's go back to Perek Tet Zayin. We looked at the conversation between Shimshon and Delila, and ultimately we talked last week about Delila's background, what's motivating her, the oddity of what's motivating her. It's not national pride or agenda. She's not functioning as if she's a Plishti, enemy of the Jewish people, enemy of Shimshon. She's sort of responding to the bribe of Senei Plishtim. We suggested that maybe the possibility that she may not in fact be Plishti by origin. Unlikely that she's Israelite, but quite possible, although it's possible. What's most likely is that she's a Canaanite living somewhere in Nachal Sarek, between the border between Eretz Plishtim and the north of Plishtim, which is the remnants of Canaan. And Shimshon, in his aftermath of his visit to Aza, finds himself with a Canaanite, which actually would not be surprising. He certainly doesn't strike me as somebody who's going to find himself with an Israelite after all that he has been through. And so he ends up with Delila in Nachal Sarek. She tries to convince him to disclose the secret of his strength. The first time around, second time around, third time around, by the fourth time he gives in. And he tells her that the secret of his strength lies in his nizirut. If he would cut his hair, then he would lose his strength. And we sort of danced around a lot of the different issues last week, but ultimately the most important and critical issue which we all raised was, what is Shimshon playing at? What's his game? Why three times he can't figure out that what Delila is trying to do? It's fairly obvious after the first time when he tells her something and she...
You know,
I know somebody who deals with the chairs and the maintenance of the chairs here in the Beis Medrash. You may want to, if you can convey a message. I think you have to take it up with the maintenance on the chairs. You know, the file a complaint.
Tag the chair.
Jackie, that's your department.
No,
Mitch. That's Mitch's department. Mitch fixes the chairs.
I see. Okay.
I register complaints.
Even
I said
funny.
Yeah. What exactly is going on here? So what I want to do actually is look at this on several levels. First is to try to understand the conversation between Shimshon and Delilah. What exactly did he tell her? What did she respond to? How did she figure out the fourth time around that it was real? What's going on? And then we'll take a look at whether there are larger implications for this story as well. So if we go back to Perek Tetzayin, starting with Pasuk. Let's start with Pasuk Vav. Pasuk Vav. Vatomad Lila El Shimshon. Verse 6, right? You have it? Vatomad Lila El Shimshon. Hagidin Aliba Me Kochacha Gadol Uvame Te Aser La Anatecha. Delilah says to Shimshon, tell me, what is the secret of your strength? By what means may you be bound? La'anotecha. La'anotecha means
to torture
you, to afflict you. Inui, it's a Pesach word, right?
Yeah.
Inui Mitzrayim, which is really quite remarkable that she would phrase it in this fashion, right? As if he, I mean, that by in itself is a giveaway as to what she's trying to do. And Shimshon seems to respond in a very strange manner. Vayomer le Shimshon. Bind me with seven fresh, moist bowstrings, which are very thin but very strong, that are not dry. Then, v'chaliti v'hayiti k'echad adam, I would be weak and like any man. So of course she does. She gets these bowstrings. She ties them up. She declares, "Plishtim alecha Shimshon, plishtim are upon you," and he just rips them off like flax in the fire. Pasuk Yud, verse 10. Vatomad lila el Shimshon, hinehi taltavi vatadaber like zavim. You mock me. You lied to me, which of course is true or not true. Did he mock her? Did he lie to her?
Yeah.
Yeah, seems so, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's got the read on him. So now tell me what the real story is. How may you be bound up? So he tries again. If you bind me with fresh rope, avotim, cords, fresh cords. I'm skipping a few verses in between, so we'll just jump around. Ashalon asabahem malacha, cords that have never been used, so they're still fresh, they're still strong. Then v'chaliti ve'itik echad adam, I would be weak like any man. So she does. She takes his fresh cords, she binds them up. She says, "Tomer la plishtim alecha Shimshon, the plishtim are upon you. The ambush is waiting for you." He throws off these cords like they are thread. Verse 13. Vatomad lila el Shimshon, hinei ad hina hitalta bi vatadaber like zavim. You mock me. You lied to me. Again. Which, of course, is quite true. Hagideli b'meti aser. I want to know how you may be bound. Vayomela im ta'argi et sheva machlafot roshi im hamasachet. You have to tie the seven braids of my hair to the loom. So Vatitka Beyated, she takes the peg from the tent peg and she knocks his hair into the tent, into the loom. Vatoma Elav Plishtim Alecha Shimshon, Plishtim are upon you. He wakes up and takes the entire loom with him as he attacks. Finally, in verse Tetvav, verse 15, Vatoma Elav Ech Tomar Ahavtich V'libcha En Iti. How do you tell me that you love me, your heart's not with me? Such a great line, because she's trying to bind him, trap him, sell him over to the plishtim. If he can't figure that out by now, he's pretty thick. Then, you know, he's maybe dumber than we thought, or give him credit for. And she turns and says, "How do you love me?" Well, if just put yourselves in Shimshon's shoes for a second and answer correctly, what the right answer would be.
Giggle, giggle.
Well, either that or whatever. You love me.
You're
you talk to my love. You want to talk? The whole thing is ridiculous. But she insists. Three times you mocked me. Refused to tell me what the secret of your strength is. Finally, she nudged him and she nagged him and she just kept going at it till finally, in which case he revealed to her his heart. Verse 17. No razor has ever come upon my head. I have been a Nazir from birth. Im gulachti v'sar v'meni kochi, if I am shaven, then my strength would depart. V'chaliti v'yediti k'chol adam, then I would be weakened and be like any man. Pasuk yitchet. V'tered lila ki higidla et kol libo. Delila here saw that he had finally told her the truth. And that's before she's done anything. But she's figured out that this time is real. Which begs the question what she thought the first three times. But okay, here she finally, let's assume for the moment, at face value, she thought innocently that it was the right answers, but she discovered that they were the wrong answers. But here she discerns something that's really different than the other three. And what she discerns here is the first question we're going to explore. So she immediately sends and calls the Sanei Plishtim and says, no, this time it's it. I got him. You know the truth. Come, bring the money with you, and let's deal with Shimshon once and for all. So the first question I want to start with, before we come back to the three times, is what is it about this last iteration, or this last disclosure, let's call it, that tells Delilah that this time it's real. It says, "Vatere ki higid, vatere Delila ki higidla et kol libo." Verse 18. She saw that this time he had given her, told her the truth, revealed the secrets of his heart. So, if you pull out that page that I gave you last week, that source page, you have it. I don't have it. Probably a bunch of this. Maybe. No, I must have extras. Those are the original. Yeah, that's one extra.
I think it's the one that says Perek.
Nope,
the
extras
are gone. It's the one that says Perek
Tetzayin
Delila.
It says Perek Tetzayin Delila in two columns. So on the left-hand side, I included a couple of the sources in the Mefarshim, how they deal with this question. What is it about his final disclosure that indicates to Delilah that this time he's really telling the truth? That's where our story begins. And from there, we will go backwards, come back to the issue of the three previous times. The Rashi, the top of the left-hand column, well, it's, before we look at the Mefarshim, let's conjecture for a moment. What is it about this last disclosure that is so significantly different from the first three that she figures out just from what he's told her that this time he's told her the truth? Let's first look at the text before we do the Mefarshim. It's a good exercise anyway. Let's look at the text first. His revelation is in verse 17. And if you compare it to the previous three instances, what is it about this disclosure that tells Delilah, this time he's telling the truth?
God's name is talking about his hair. God's name?
Talking about ropes.
And he's talking about God's name.
Well, how would she? Let's do one at a time.
God's name is mentioned.
He mentions God's name. that's different. He hasn't done that before. A little bit out of character, maybe, for Shimshon. One possibility. Adina, what are you suggesting?
So pull me out of Tanakh. Pull me out of another Tanakh. The methodology. It's hair. It's not ropes. It's not twine.
Right. Okay, fine tune this. She doesn't know anything about hair. So why would she assume that the hair is different from the previous indications?
Because she already went through it a couple times with the other, you know.
He gave a little backup story.
Well, the last time was also somehow connected to hair, right? You tied the hair to the loom. But okay. But we're getting closer. I think so.
His introduction, but you get a lot of Kali Bo that says, you know, what does that mean? Obviously, had a conversation about what he went and what his life was like and what he's been going through.
Right. So, Vayagedlat Kolibo introduces this final disclosure with the statement of he revealed to her all of his heart, which could mean simply that he told her the truth. But you're suggesting it meant more than that.
Right.
That it meant a kind of broader conversation.
Before he tells her about the hair, he talks about what's in his heart.
Okay. Any other suggestions? All good. All excellent. Any other suggestions?
Divulged his history of being the Nazir that he hadn't spoken with her about yet.
He discloses to her that he had been a Nazir. Okay. Follow through.
I'm not sure she would know what a Nazir was.
Right. Not sure she would know what a Nazir means. Maybe she would. So. But why does that... why is that different from the previous disclosures? I think you're onto something, but follow it up. All right, so let's take a look at the Mefarshim. I think essentially the Mefarshim all take various forms of the suggestions that you've offered here, which I think very, very correctly so. I think there are various opinions you offer, but they're essentially parallel to what we've suggested. Rashi, which I think is probably closest to what Janet was saying, Rashi says the following, and it's a very short comment, a very powerful comment. V'tered lila ki higidla, what did you say? That Lila saw ki higidla et kol libo. The Lila saw that he revealed his heart. The first thing Rashi picks up on is the fact that what she discerns isn't necessarily in the substance of what he reveals, but in the manner in which he reveals it. That's the phrase that you picked up on. Vayegedlat kolibo. He reveals his whole heart. He speaks to her differently than he did before. To which Rashi adds three words, which I think are really very profound words. Nikarin divrei emet. When you speak the truth, it's discernible. It doesn't have to have an objective, concrete reason why this disclosure was different from the others, other than in the manner in which he spoke or expressed or disclosed or conversed, that ve'aged lat kol libo, here he really lets her know this is coming from the heart. Essentially, following along the lines of the famous statement, which actually doesn't have a real source, although it's quoted as a real source, and that is dvarim hayotzim min alev nichnasim el halev. Words that come from the heart enter the heart. We quote that phrase all the time, although I don't think I've ever found the actual source for it.
About Truma, but, you know, Nedev Libo.
That's referring more to generosity and tzedakah.
No, but it's like that you're giving it with a full heart. You know, let's say everybody writes a check for $100.
Right.
You know,
right.
Do you do it because you feel, oh, I'm forced to, or you feel like, oh, I wish I could do more?
Right. And here it's talking more in the context of what the conversation is about, the truth of your mind, but
right.
Essentially the heart and the mind here working together. When he finally says to her, hey, you know, cut the hair and it's all over, and she realizes that he's speaking from a different place than when he talks about being bound by fresh cords and bound by fresh ropes and all this other stuff, the conversation is of a different tenor. That's one possibility. Vedak offers two additional possibilities, and then we're going to offer a third. Vedak asks the question, Ki yigidlat kol libo mehechan yada, where did she know that this was the real thing? So first, so he, the Radak's approach to this question comes from not how he spoke, but what he said. Different from Rashi, which is looking at it in the perspective of the tenor in which he conversed. Radak is looking at it from the perspective of the substance of what he disclosed. Amru Razal, first he quotes a Midrash Chazal, Yodat haita ota harisha'a, that wicked person, that Dalila, that wicked individual, knew, understood, batot tzaddik, that nazi, that this tzaddik, this Shimshon, who Medrash, consistent with the Midrashic approach to Shimshon, sees him as a tzaddik from beginning to end, la haya motzi shem shemayim levatala, would not express God's name in vain. I think you mentioned the issue of God. Who somebody mentioned the issue? You mentioned the issue of God's name, but I think your perception was probably a little bit different from the way the Medrash presents it. Am I correct?
I think so, yeah.
Right. I'll pick that up. We'll come back to that. But the Medrash says that Shimshon was not, would not have used God's name in vain. The Kivan Shamar Nazir Elokim, the moment he said, I am a Nazir Elokim in a beten, I am a Nazir to God, the moment he expressed it in that way, Yadashe Gidlat Kolibo. Now, Judy, you mentioned God's name before, but I think you mentioned it differently. You had intended the comment about God's name to be a little bit different than the way the Medrash intended, correct? Did you?
I meant that that gives a validity, that it's, he's sincere, and it's a different...
Okay, and why would that be...
I mean, Hashem's name was never mentioned in anything before.
That's what I thought you were referring to, in fact. This is so out of character for Shem, because he never talks in God's name. It was one, and the Medrash presents it from the other side of the coin. He's such a tzaddik, you wouldn't take God's name in vain. When you look at the story, he never takes God's name, period.
I mean, I don't mean to disagree with Radak.
No, he's not buying this. He's just quoting this Medrash.
I mean, would you refer to Shimshon as a tzaddik?
That's the big question. That's the big question with which we start at the beginning of the year, right? Holy man or thug? Holy man is another name for tzaddik, and thug is another name for all kinds of things, right? That's ultimately the question of who he is, and my essentially thesis with which we've developed this whole curriculum is that there are two periods of his life, and that it's for a certain period of life, regardless of what his behavior is, the notion of being a tzaddik is being the messenger, the role that God, the tool that God is using in order to achieve his goal. At some point or another, that shifts, and where that shift takes place, we're suggesting took place back in the beginning of the Perek in Aza. So I'm not convinced, and neither is the Radak, that at this point in time, you could describe Shimshon in the role of the tzaddik. So Radak quotes it, certainly an approach. It's an observation on the lines of the same observation that Judy made, which is that this third answer invokes God's name, which the first three did not. Talked about cords and ropes and looms, but he never talked about God, and he certainly didn't talk about being an Nazir Elokim. The Radak picks up on another additional nuance. And that's the following. It says, V'yesh lefaresh, ki hikira b'dvarav, ki emet amarla, she saw that he disclosed the truth, ki amarla hasiba, sheba avuro hayalo hakoach. Fundamental difference here was that he explained where his strength came from.
The reason
for his strength. He gave it a rationale that began to make sense to her. Up until now, what did he say? What's the secret of my strength? Oh, bind me with rope and I'll be like any man. Bind me with cords and I'll be like any man. Bind me to the loom and I'll be like any man. He never explained to her the rationale, the logic behind the action and the result. Because there was no logic behind the action and the result. He was, in her mind, teasing her. It's an easy tease, easy mistake to make, right? He was teasing her, of course he was. Whereas the moment he says, I've been in the Nazir Elokim from birth, therefore I have long hair, is clearly visible. He looks differently than everybody else. That's been the secret of my strength, essentially saying something along the lines of, God has been with me, God has been the source of my strength, because I've been loyal to him as a Nazir. If I act disloyally, if I shave my hair, if I cut my hair, violate my oath of Nazirut, then I've taken away the reason for why I have the strength in the first place, then I really will be like any other man. It's a logical answer that's so profoundly different from any of the first three expressions, because he's explained the background, which he did not do earlier. And that, says the Radak, ultimately is how she picks up that this is real.
Why didn't he say it from the beginning?
Well, that's the question we asked last week that I promised her I'd come back to. Why doesn't he just go straight for the... if he's going to reveal his strength, why doesn't he just do it? And if he's not going to, then why does he give in the end? And why does he figure? Why does he trust her? What does he expect her to do after three times that he, whatever he information he's given her, she's tried to bind him and sell him over to the Plishtim? What does he expect her to do in this last iteration? So, what I was going to suggest to you, in part based on what the Radak, I think, is alluding to or hinting at, which is that, is the following. I don't think Shimshon is thick, an idiot, although sometimes he acts that way, and I don't think he's playing with her. I think in a very real way he knows exactly what she intends to do. The moment he says to her, bind me with fresh bowstrings, and I will be like any other man. Even before that, what was Delilah's request? How may you be bound so that... What was the request? What was the phraseology? In the very beginning, the very first instance, when she first formulates the question, Uvamet te aser... La'anotecha. Now, if you're Shimshon and you offer her any answer, you're testing her. And if she binds him, declares Plishtim Alecha Shimshon, the Orev Yoshev Labacheder, once, twice, three times, what does he expect her to be doing?
Turning him over to those.
You get the sense that he expects her to go through this motion. So what's driving this game that he's playing with her? So what I was going to suggest to you is that I think Shimshon knows exactly the game that she's playing, and he's waiting for her to finally do it right. That's the question. Why? But that's precisely what he's waiting for. He's waiting for her to get it right. The only difference is that he does something which she did not expect. And that is?
Tell her the truth.
No, before he told her the truth. She expected him to tell her the truth. Mm-hmm. And he didn't. And that confused her. But I suspect from the very beginning, she expected him to tell her the truth, and he didn't. What did he tell her? So let's see what he told her.
Things that weren't going to work.
Lies.
Some arbitrary, ordinary, out-of-the-mill, random things that weren't going to work? Or very specific things? Or very specific things?
When they said they were going to bind him and give him the police.
There was some parallel to what happened with Yehuda. But let's take a look at what he told her. What were the different statements he made to her as to what would bind his strength?
First he says, wet bowstrings.
Seven.
No, before we get to seven. Did you say seven out of the beginning?
Yes,
he does.
Seven fresh bowstrings.
Even better. The first is Shiva Yitarim Lachim. Seven fresh bowstrings.
That were never used.
Meaning strong, fresh, right from the factory.
They were never dried.
Very dry. Okay. Second. And that clearly didn't work. Second.
Ropes.
Avotim.
Chadashim.
What's the difference between Yetarim and Avatim?
The thicker.
Well, why do I have seven here and I don't have seven here? Why did she say seven? Why did he say seven bowstrings here and just ropes here, cords?
Is it based on the? Is it like a play on the word or something?
No, just a simple logic of what these things are.
The avatim are heavier, maybe.
Yeah, what are avatim?
They're thicker. They're ropes.
They're seven strands of ropes.
They're thick ropes. Cords, right? What's a rope
seven.
Made out of?
You don't need seven.
Smaller.
It's made out of smaller cool. string, all twined together, twisted together. So, essentially, seven individual cords by themselves
makes up probably one avatim.
Right? It's a progression. We move from seven individual strong
bowstrings,
to twine, big, thick rope, avotim chadashim. So you take all that twine and you twist it together, and you get a
rope.
So I don't need to talk about seven, because I have more than seven in the avotim themselves.
So what's the significance of the seven?
We'll see where we're going. Number three, what's the third one?
Take seven locks of his hair.
Take seven braids of hair. Sheva machlefot roshi. And?
And
attach them
to the web of the loom.
And tie them to the masach. To the loom. So oddly enough, what do I have in this third progression?
Seven.
Right, and then when it's all over, and he finally discloses to her kol libo, what does he say?
If she cuts, he's never shaved his head, and if he cut her hair, then he would be like any other man.
Right.
One second.
Where's the? Take a look at it again. That's verse 13 is Titkat Sheva Machlefot Roshi, the seven braids of my hair. And then in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Gulachti V'Sar Menu Kuchi. What does she say?
If I'm shaved, then my strength
will be. Vatikra La'ish. When she finally cuts his hair. Vatikra La'ish. Vategalach et sheva machlefot rosho. Vategalach et sheva machlefot rosho. Now let's put it together. What does Shimshon's hair look like?
I was just thinking of that. Like,
ropes,
does he have a reggae thing?
With all these braids? Wait, what does he have?
There's
it
no
says exactly what he has.
Red locks.
He has seven braids. That's exactly what it says. He has seven braids. Now, we know he has seven braids.
Yeah.
Because he told her that part of this, when he was making fun of her, so to speak, he said, if you take the seven braids, my seven braids, and tie them to the loom, right, which clearly wasn't going to do much at all. Correct? But we know that he has seven braids of hair. Correct? What does a braid of hair look like?
It's like rope.
Doesn't it look like rope?
Right.
And what does a single strand of hair look like?
Like the Yitzharim.
And notice the number?
77.
In other words, what I would suggest to you is Shimshon is not mocking her.
He's building up a riddle.
He's presented her with a
riddle.
Now, why on earth would Shimshon present a riddle? And the answer to that question is self-evident. Why would Shimshon speak in riddles?
He's testing her?
Nope.
He's had a riddle.
Because he always speaks in riddles. Because that's Shimshon's character from the day we met him. When he walked into the Timna. And he went to the Plishtim and he challenged the Plishtim. How did he challenge them? With a riddle. How did he challenge Delilah? So you want to know the secret of my hair? Of my strength? I'll tell you the secret of my strength. Here's a riddle. And he starts with bowstrings. Fresh, moist bowstrings that look like hair. It's not hard to figure out. You just have to know what he's thinking. And when she can't figure that out, he takes it one step further. He talked about seven. Just look at his head. He's got seven braids of hair. Can't figure out that seven bowstrings refer to seven blocks of hair? Okay, well, how about seven? How about a cord of rope? Can you figure that that looks like a braid of hair? And Lila still can't figure it out. So he says to her, okay, well, if you take the seven locks of my hair, bowstring, rope, hair, seven locks, put it together, Delilah, and tie it to the loom, maybe you'll figure it out. And when she still can't figure it out, so finally he says to her, okay, so I'll tell you the secret. In other words, what I'm suggesting to you is that Shimshon, from the very word go, is looking for her to do precisely what she does in the end, which is to cut the darn hair and rid him of this burden and get him, hand him over to the Plishtim so that he can finally end this life, which has been a burden to him ever since he failed with Bnei Yehuda. He's been looking for a way to commit suicide. He's just refused to do it
himself.
So he went to Aza, to the zone in Aza. Well, that didn't work. He ran away with the doors of the house. So then he goes into the grips of Delilah. And she's being bribed by the Plishtim. Plishtim alecha Shimshon. And then Shimshon's waiting there, lying there, saying, oh, it's great, okay, come and get me. The only thing he's refused to do is speak. He's got an oath. He's lived with this oath this whole life. He has not revealed to a single living soul that he is a Nazir and what the Nazirut means to him. He's been loyal to this oath. It takes a great deal to get him to violate that oath. But he's looking for somebody to take it away from him, to take the burden off him without him being responsible for it. So he hands her the secret. He just does it in riddles. One riddle, two riddles, three riddles. And when he finally realizes that she can't figure it out, and then after all of that, she has to nag him to death, not because he doesn't want to reveal the secret of his strength, but because he knows the moment he does so actively, he's in direct, active violation of a fundamental component of his oath to God from the day he was born. And it's a huge jump for him. But he is desperately looking for a way to call this game over. He's been looking for a way to call this game over from the moment he failed with Bnei Yehuda. He's just refused to do it biyadayim, as they say.
And there was no one else beforehand that could have done it for him? Like, could he, was there...
We went from one story to the next. What do you mean beforehand? There was no beforehand. We went from Bnei Yehuda to Aza to Delilah. Right? We don't even know the time frame here. But that's the sense you get from Shimshon is not that he's such an idiot he can't figure out what she's driving at. But the other way around. He knows exactly what she's driving at. She just can't figure him out. She can't figure out the riddle. He's played it out for her in black and white, in blue and white in this case. And that's what she can't figure out. So finally, after all the nagging and after all the nudging, he knows exactly what's happening. He knows. The moment he says so, she's going to cut that hair, and he's going to be in violation, active violation of his oath of Nizrut, because he told her, and he'll pay the consequences for it.
Which he's been,
you'll pardon the expression, dying to do.
But doesn't he look different than everybody else? He looks like a Nazir. People don't figure out that he looks different.
So that's an interesting question. How common is the Nazir in this world? Certainly Nazir from birth is very uncommon.
Yeah.
So he looks different than everybody else. But that, would you figure out that that's the secret of his strength?
Might if you were Jewish.
Yeah, well, he's not walking around with the look of, you know, loyalty to God and on every word he utters. He's not, you know, he's not walking around saying, I'm strong because God is my strength. Like, this is a private... Nobody in this world, not the Canaanites, not the Plishtites, not even the Israelites, and not even Bnei Yehuda, are thinking along the lines of his strength is in God's providential support of Shimshon. They just look at him as a humongous monster and trying to figure out a way to subdue the monster.
What I don't get is, why did he pray to God for water then if he was in such despair and he wanted to die?
Well, that's the end of that story. Yeah. That's the very, like, right there. So there's a huge jump between, a gap. There's a period of crisis, right, that takes time to settle in. Between Perek Tet Vav and Perek Tet Zayin, right, that's the end of 20 years. Then, right,
then
so
the
it's yeah, the story of Azaz is where that crisis takes place.
Do we know how
and you see it in Shimshon's behavior. You see it in the behavior in Azza. You see the despair, the throw-it-all-away attitude, and you see it again with Delilah. He's thrown his life into her hands and said, take me. He's just waiting for her to figure it out until he finally has to do what he has not wanted to do all along, which is spell it out in words. But he certainly has spelled it out in riddle. And that's the answer, I think, of why it takes three times. Because he's trying to get her to figure out the riddle, and she just doesn't. Until he spells it out for her.
Do you know how old he is at this point?
No. Mm. No.
Not in his 40s.
We have no idea. We have no idea. Does it even say how old he is when he dies? No, it doesn't.
We but heard he was around 40 when he left.
Assuming he's 20 when he starts his world life with the Timnite. Give or take, and it's 20 years of that whole story.
Right. So
give or take, but we don't know, you know. But there's no point in which this age is mentioned, so it's all conjecture. But really, that's the story of Shimshon. He's at this point given up his nizirut, and he's done so actively. If you remember our conversation way back at the beginning of our discussion of Shimshon, when we raised the question of free will. Where does Shimshon have free will? Where doesn't he have free will? Given the fact that his behavior with the Timnite was predestined, his embrace of Philistine women was part of God's plan. The text tells me that. It's a unique phrase. His father and mother didn't realize that he was going after Philistine women because God wanted him to, because God wanted to seek a pretext against the Plishtim. It's a really remarkable moment. And what we had suggested was that with all of the predetermined destiny of Shimshon, his mother is barren. Shimshon shouldn't have been born. He was born for a mission. The role of a Nazir to balance the drive that God was going to implant in him in order to get him to go and be this agent amongst the Plishtim, to balance it with the Nazirut, where does his free will lie? We suggest that his free will lies specifically in the arena of his Nizirut. And the moment he actively agrees to give it up, that's where he crosses the line of his free will. And at that point, he's accountable. His mission is over. So it's no surprise that he's then taken captive by the Plishtim and it's over. And really, he will die in the next story. How that story ends up, we'll come back to. But that's essentially where Shimshon is at. Fatik Tzai Nafsho Lamut. So that's where I see the iterations, the first and the second and the third. It's all part of what I think is part of the pattern from his first entry into Azza. This, in the aftermath of Bnei Yehuda, this act of desperation that really has led Shimshon on a one-way trajectory into the hands of the Plishtim. Before I move to the next piece, let me stop for a second and ask questions, comments.
Will this explain why he went to a prostitute?
So that was the previous story. We suggested that was also part of his desperation.
Yeah.
Right? You see him in various ways losing sense of purpose. Right? The Azza, much like and we compared it to the story of Yehuda and Tamar, where Yehuda also has that moment of despair, loss of purpose, ends up in the hands of Tamar. She, on the other hand, has enough purpose and enough focus to bring him back. Whereas in this case, it's the opposite. Right? He walks into the hands of the Zona or into the hands of Delilah in order to, in a sense, commit suicide, and that's precisely what happens. And that's exactly what, and he plays into that role. There's a technical issue at the end of why it says when he woke up the last time, the fourth time, why it says that he woke up and he didn't know that God had abandoned him, he didn't know that he'd lost his strength. So the Radakan, I think, correctly points out that he went to sleep. We have this image that this is all happening in one shot, but it's not. There's time lapse between each event. So it could be a week, it could be a month, it could be 6 months. We have no idea what the time frame here is. But at one point or another, he tells her what the secret is, and then, you know, he's waiting and waiting. We don't. It's not necessarily so that the next night she shaves his head and suddenly he knows what's going on. It could be a time lapse of a week, of a month, and every day he's waiting. In the meantime, he wakes up in the middle of the night, not realizing, oh, this is the night in which she's cut his hair. Wakes up in the middle of the night, thinks he still has his strength, and is subdued and understands that all of this is for naught. Yeah.
I don't think it could be that much time, because she wants to do it for money. So I would think she'd be motivated.
Yeah, she's nudging him every night.
It doesn't have to be weeks for the sense of the wake up in the middle of the night to be confused.
Right,
to be relevant.
I don't think it was like years.
No, I would agree. I don't think it's years. I think she's got a clear plan, and he's got a clear plan.
Their
plans are in consonance with each other. The only difference is that he's not yet prepared to say it explicitly. But I think that their plans are exactly on in consonance. Unfortunately. That's really the tragedy of Shimshon. This whole chapter is really the tragedy. It's the downfall of Shimshon. And Chazal describe it as such. Tchilat kilkulo ba'aza. His downfall starts in Aza. This is part of his downfall. It's not his downfall and then he comes and he takes an about face and he says, oh, and then he got tricked and trapped. This is part of that agenda. Now, the only question remaining in this regard, I think, is the significance of the sequence of three. Why does he wait three times? So, I mean, I don't necessarily need a better answer than this, because it takes a couple of times to go through this iteration of you know, here's the riddle, figure it out. Here's hint number two, figure it out. Here's hint number three, figure it out. However, there is a certain irony to the pattern of three iterations that fail, and the fourth that essentially leads to the consequences that happen. That's not an uncommon pattern in Tanakh. There are many times where you have this sort of recurring pattern of things that happen in sets of three iterations of three repetitions of an event, and the fourth, the symbol of or the significance of what it's about, a kind of a targeted focus. This is an issue that is a whole subject of discussion in the world of biblical scholarship. It's referred to in the literature as Shloshav Yarba'ah, 3 and 4. It's based on a pattern that appears in a couple of psukim in Tanakh, in Sefer Mishlei and in Sefer Amos, where you have, for example, the phrase in Sefer Amos, Al Shloshah Pishei Yisrael V'Al Arba'ah Lo Ashivenu. For three iniquities, I'll forgive them, but for the fourth, I won't. We operate in a mindset of three strikes, you're out. Tanakh operates in a mindset of four strikes, you're out. In other words, the first time, the second time, the third time, and then the fourth. So for three iterations, God says, I'll forgive Israel, but the fourth time is already no good. If you go back to the Aseret HaDibrot, Poked Avon Avot Al Banim Ve'al Bnei Banim Ve'al Shilashim Ve'al Ribayim, when it says that God visits the iniquities of parents and children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren for four generations, it doesn't mean that each of the four generations is punished. It means that God withholds the punishment for up to four generations to give four generations a chance to do tshuva, first, second, third. By the fourth, God says no. So it's not three strikes you're out, it's four strikes you're out. And Tanakh operates in that model across the board. And there are so many various stories in Tanakh on multiple levels that that play out this recurring theme of three iterations of repetitive testing until the fourth, in which you set the message in place. I'll show you a few, just because it's just an interesting subject by itself, sort of patterning in Tanakh. It's a subject which straddles between the world of biblical scholarship and biblical criticism. So you have to be a little careful with when you deal with literary style in Tanakh, because it's a subject which can be misunderstood or misapplied. But I'll give you a couple of very interesting examples where you see this kind of patterning of first time, second time, third time, and then the fourth time is where it's all focused on. Actually, let's start from Shoftim, since we're already in Sefer Shoftim. Let's start from the example in Sefer Shoftim and go to... Where am I going to go to? Mashal Yatom. Mashal Yatom is in the aftermath of Gidon, Avi Melech. Chapter 9. Mashal Yotam. Okay, so let's take a look at verse 7. Chapter 9, verse 7. Ve'yagidu liyotam ve'elach ve'yamod b'rosh har gvizim. Yotam is the last remaining child of Gidon, whose all the children were assassinated by Ahimelech in a big coup to take over the kingdom and to establish a first attempt, failed attempt at the establishment of a kingdom in Israel, or in Shechem. Ve'agidu liyotam ve'elach ve'amod b'rosh har gvizim. Yotam went up, if you remember the story, he stands on the top of the mountain of har gvizim. Ve'isa kolo ve'yikra, and he tells the story. He tells the people of Shechem, listen to me. And he tells them a story. It's a mashal, a parable. What's the mashal? Halach halchu ha'etzim limshach alehem melech. They went to the trees wanted to go and appoint for themselves a king. Remember the metaphor, the parable? V'yemu lezayit malcha aleinu. They went to the olive, and they said, reign over us. I can't do it. I can't abandon my produce, which is the oil. So, verse 10, so they went to the te'ina, to the fig tree, and they said, you reign over us. No, the fig tree said, I can't do it. I can't abandon my sweetness, which is the fruit of my tree, which is the date. Verse 12. Vayemu ha'etzim la'gefen. So they went to the gefen, to the vine, and they said, "At malach aleinu, you reign over us." I can't abandon my produce either, which is the grape, which is wine. And therefore, vayemru kol ha'etzim la'atad. So they went to the bramble, and they have all conversation with the bramble, the thorn bush, which eventually is the mashal for Avimelech. What the story is. What the mashal means and how it fits into the story of Avimelech, we went through at length when we studied this, I think, last year. But look at the structure. How many examples are there in the metaphor before you get to the fourth, which is the real purpose of this story? Three. And today we would talk about, we would most likely write it in the form of two, and then the third being the conclusion. Because that's how we're used to. We're used to things in threes, not in fours. And Tanakh is always written in forms of fours. Give another example. Bilam. Take a look in Peshat Balak. Verse chapter 22, verse 21 of Bet Chafalef. Ve'yakom Bilam ba'boker ve'achavoshet atuno ve'yelach im sarei Moav. Bilam gets up in the morning, goes together with the messengers from Moav, and he starts his journey to curse Israel. Ve'yicharaf alakim ki alechu ve'yitzef malach Hashem baderech le'satan lo. God is angry that he goes, and he places a malach to stop him. With me? V'hudah chevel atono, shnena ravimo, and he's riding on his donkey. V'tere ha'adon et malach Hashem nitzav baderech, v'chabosh lufa biyado. This donkey sees this malach with the outstretched sword. V'tet ha'aton min haderech, v'telech basedeh. So the donkey shifts directions. Everybody with me? Bamidbar, chapter 22, verse 23. Chabet chabgim. Vayach Bilam at Aton, and Bilam hit the donkey. Next, Vayamod Malach Hashem b'Mishol HaKramim. This Malach stood in the vineyard with a gader miziv, a gader mizeh, and each side there was a fence. Vatere Aton Malach Hashem v'telechetz lakir. The donkey saw the Malach Hashem, so it pushed against the wall, and Bilam hit the donkey. Verse 26, V'yosef malach Hashem avo v'yamod b'mokom tzar, she'en derech lintot yamin u'smol. It's a narrow passage. V'teri adon malach Hashem v'tirbat tachat bil'am, v'yachat ha'atom b'makel. Third time, he saw the donkey, the donkey stops, he crouches down, and Bilam hits him. And after three times, and Bilam hits the donkey, v'yiftach Hashem et pi ha'atom, then God opens up the mouth of the donkey. So he's sort of, another example, I won't bother flipping to, but I'll tell you, you'll see it in a second. Eliyahu Hanavi in Har Chorev, Eliyahu's famous vision, where he's put into the cleft of the rock, and he sees God places before him a great ruach, and he says, is that where you'll find God? And he says, Lo Baruch Hashem. We read this as a Haftarah. Lo Baruch Hashem. Then he sees a great fire. And he says, Lo Ba'esh Hashem. And then he sees, what's the third? The fourth is the voice. That's exactly where I'm going. Go out and stand on the mountain before God. You'll see a great wind breaking rocks. Lo beruach Hashem. God is not to be found in the wind. And then a great noise. Lo beruach Hashem. God is not to be found in the rash. Then fire. God is not to be found in the fire. Then a still silent voice, which of course is where Eliyahu says, where God says to Eliyahu, that's. But again, ruach, esh, ra'ash, and then. So you have this constant recurring pattern of, to draw a point, to draw a message, you have three iterations of similar style, and then the fourth is the conclusion, which is a much more elaborate conclusion, because it ultimately is where the first three are directing or going. So you find that, and I think in the story of Shimshon also, where he's hinting to her. For our purposes, it could have been one hint, two hints, but the fact that there are three followed by the conclusion, I think, is a significant pattern, because it fits into a broader pattern in Tanakh as a whole. But clearly the message being one of him having given up and given her these hints at what the secret of his strength is, and ultimately her not being able to figure it out until he tells it to her, much as the Timnite could not figure out the riddle until he disclosed it. The last example I'll share with you, for the sake of giving you something to discuss at the Pesach Seder, is what I spoke about Shabbos afternoon, which is that the most powerful example of this is the notion of the four expressions of redemption. Because when you read the four expressions of redemption, you feel the same pattern. What do I mean? When we talk about four cups of wine because of four expressions of redemption, it's all based on a set of verses in Sefer Shemot. Those verses raise, take a look at them for a moment, it's chapter 6 in Shemot. Starting with verse 6. L'chein amol levnei Yisrael, ani Hashem, v'yotzeiti etchem mitachat zivlot Mitzrayim, I will take you out from under the burden of Egypt. V'hitzalti etchem mi'avodatam, I will save you from their servitude. V'ga'al 6:6. Shemot 6:6. Chapter 6, starting with verse 6. V'ga'alti etchem bezor netiyah v'shvatim gdolim, I will redeem you with an outstretched hand and with great wonders. V'lakachti etchem li la'am, I will take you for me as a nation. V'hiti lachem l'elokim, and I will be your God. V'idatem ki ani Hashem elokechem, amotzi etchem mitachat zivlot Mitzrayim, and you will know that I am God who took you out of the land of Egypt from the burden of Egypt. V'hiti etchem la'aretz, I will bring you to the land, asher nesati et yadi latet otah la'avraham Yitzchak li'Yaakov, that I have promised to give to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. I will give it to you as an inheritance. Now, this passage is the source for the concept of the four expressions of redemption, and if you spell them out, they are V'hotzeiti etchem mitachat sivlot Mitzrayim, V'yitzalti etchem me'avodatam, V'ga'alti etchem bizroa nituya uvishvatim gedolim, which are great wonders, and V'lakachti etchem li le'am. I will save you, I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, I will take you for me. Chazal ask a very famous question: why don't we have a fifth cup of wine corresponding to a fifth expression of redemption, which is the next verse, which is, of course, Ve'veiti etchem el ha'aretz. And there's a lot of other expressions in this phrase, in this passage as well. I will bring you to the land. I will give you the land as an inheritance. V'idatem, you will know that I am Hashem, ki ani Hashem, that I have done all this. There's a lot of phrases in this paragraph. Why do we assume that there are only four expressions of redemption and not five? And so what I suggest at Shabbos afternoon, we also compared it to other psukim in Yechezkel, which I won't do now, is that this is also a pattern of 3 plus 1. And that these three statements are a build-up. Because essentially, they're synonymous with each other. The nuanced differences between them, but fundamentally, V'yotzeiti v'yitzalti v'ga'alti are all referring to the same thing. The process of leaving Egypt. The mechanism by which we emerged from the burden of Egypt was what? The mechanism. The tool used.
The ten plagues.
Well, the plagues, right? The mechanism by which God removed us from the bird, from the servitude of Egypt was the
ten plagues.
The mechanism by which God redeemed us with an outstretched arm and with great wonders?
Ten plagues.
So these three are synonymous. Just different ways of presenting the concept of the plagues of Egypt. Whereas V'lakachti etchem li la'am is a reference to V'yaiti lachem le'elohim, and I will be your God, is a reference to Ma'amar HaSinai.
and the Brit we enter into with God as a consequence of the first three. Now that Brit and those consequences are not just one word, but that Brit and that consequence is an entire picture. I will take you to me as a people, you. I will be your God, I will bring you to the land, there I will establish as an inheritance to you, you will know that I am God who has done all this. All of that is part of the consequence of the Brit between God and Israel. And that's what Chazal talk about, four expressions of redemption, even though there's a lot more here, because what they're really pointing to is that the fourth, it's not just four equal statements, it's three is this kind of constant iteration build-up to the conclusion, which is always the fourth. And the fourth, in this case, is the Brit between God and Israel. So the pattern that we're describing here, the pattern of 3 plus 1, is a pattern referred to in text, in Psukim and Mishle, and in Amos, Ashloshah Pishei Yisrael. When you play it out in Tanakh, actually has a number of very interesting applications, one of which was our story about Shimshon, and so I thought I would share that with you as well.
Rabbi Shulman, can you apply the concept of Shloshava Arba'a to the women with Shimshon? Because it was the wife, going back to the wife, the Zona, and then Delilah?
You could. It depends on how you divide the women in his life, whether you divide them into three stories or four. But you could. If you divided them into three, if you took the story of the Timnite and divided it into two, then you could theoretically look at Delilah as the fourth. The only difference there being is that I think I would put the Zona in Aza and Delilah in the same boat.
Okay.
But certainly the pattern of his disclosure of the riddle, I think, is very clearly part of this picture. Okay, we will adjourn here. And Bezvat Hashem, after Pesach, we'll gather for our conclusion of Shimshon, and then stay tuned.